It is an ancient view that truth, goodness, and beauty cannot in the end conflict. Maybe the degeneration of beauty into kitsch comes precisely from the postmodern loss of truthfulness, and with it, the loss of moral direction. Roger Scruton.
This is the Redeemed Imagination Podcast, a podcast of the Anselm Society on re-enchanting the church.
Hello and welcome back to the Redeemed Imagination Podcast in our continuing series on the centric genius. Before we begin, I want to loop you in a little bit in case you missed my explanation earlier on the podcast, a little explanation of what it is that we are doing. We're trying something a little bit different this spring between now and our Imagination Redeemed Conference in April. We're going to be doing a series on something we call the centric genius. More on that in a second. But it's part of a larger project that we're doing. The mission of the Anselm Society is a renaissance of the Christian imagination. Now, the funny thing about a mission statement that bold, that big, and that short is that every word in that mission statement has great significance. And when we say Renaissance, we mean something specific. When we say Christian, we mean something specific. And when we say imagination, we mean something specific. So this spring, we're going to look at Renaissance. This summer, we're going to look at Christian. And this fall, we're going to look at imagination. We're not simply going to spend a ton of podcast episodes talking about a single word. What we are going to do is take that word, unpack it a bit, and delve into something related to it that we think is worth exploring. So the spring or winter-spring portion here is going to be on Renaissance, a word that means rebirth. And this is perfect because we are leading up to April 24th and 25th, our Imagination Redeemed Conference. By the way, tickets for that are going really fast, so buy yours now. If you're coming from out of town, make your travel plans. We're going to be having a ton of fun conversations at the conference that are going to pick up right where this content series leaves off. We're going to be delving into a ton of our favorite stories, favorite pieces of art. We're going to talk about Silver Chair. We're going to talk about Middle Earth. We're going to talk about George MacDonald, and we're going to talk about the connective tissue between all of those favorite stories. What is it that makes us love those stories so much? Those specific stories, what ties them together? What connects them with the great story? And how does the great story connect to our lives? So to tee that up, we're going to spend some time in this idea of Renaissance. The reason that we use the word Renaissance in the Anselm Society is that we think when we talk about a Christian imagination, a well-orbed, fully orbed, robust thing, we think we're talking about something that has in fact existed before and can exist again. That does not mean we've got a favorite time period between 1143 and 1220 AD that we are desperately hoping to copy and paste onto 21st century America. What that means is that we think that we are not, as moderns, we are not the best at everything that has ever been done. There are things to be learned from what artists have done well in the past that they're not quite so good at now, what the church has done well in the past that it's not quite so good at now. And one of the things that the church used to do a bit better than it does now is minister to artists and minister through artists. We've got a vision, an assumption in modernity that the artist is supposed to be an eccentric genius. Supposed to be an oddball, supposed to be a loner, supposed to be at the fringes of society, lonely, misunderstood, and commenting on society from its margins, from a position of alienation. A lot of artists struggle with what they feel to be this reality, and other artists, frankly, see it as a bit of a heroic ideal. almost something to aspire to, not because they want to be lonely and misunderstood, but because the loneliness and the position of feeling misunderstood is part of the badge of honor, part of what shows that they are in fact an artist. It wasn't always that way. It's a relatively recent invention, the notion that an artist is supposed to be so divorced from everything that he or she wants most in life, that everyone wants most in life: community, relationship, love, understanding. So we've gotten together today. I'm here with Ansom board members, Lancia Smith and Heidi White, and we're going to talk about an alternative vision. And that vision we're terming, for obvious reasons, not the eccentric genius, the decentered genius, but the centric genius. Mm-hmm. So welcome to both of you.
Thanks, Brian. It's good to be here.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks for hanging in there with my monologue.
That was great.
Well, let's just start by unpacking a little bit what we mean when we say centric genius. As I discovered in writing the blog post with which we kicked off the series, there are a ton of different angles that you can take on it. We're actually going to be looking over the course of this series across our Belief to See podcast, our Redeemed Imagination podcast, and our blog on the website. We're going to be looking at all kinds of different angles. We're going to be telling stories. We're going to be looking at in history. We're going to be looking at the present. Just trying to encapsulate all of that in one piece was a lot harder than I expected it to be. What comes to your minds when you think of the term centric genius?
I'll take a stab at that. Have y'all seen the new Little Women yet?
Yes.
Not yet.
So it's great. It's great. And one of the reasons that it's so good is that the angle that the director takes with it, which I think is lovely, is as it explores art and the voice of these young women, particularly Jo, throughout the story, which is just beautifully woven together, that one of the conclusions, and this isn't giving away too much, that the story seems to arrive at is that Jo, as an artist, as a writer, as a voice, is a product of her people. Her art is inextricably tied to the experiences of her life, which those experiences are inextricably tied to the people that love her and that she loves. Mm. And that the implication of that is that she wouldn't be the artist she is without those people, that we are formed by our community, and that formation leads to the goodness, whether it's moral goodness or aesthetic goodness, of the art that we offer to the world. So the idea of an artist divorced from society, isolated from relationship with loving people, who doesn't know how to love and be loved by the church, means that that's going to become a part of their art. So I think when we're talking about the idea of eccentric or removed from center versus the centered or centric genius, that's a lot of what we're talking about, is those ties, those bonds that people have, that artists have with each other, with the people in their lives, that forms their art.
I'd piggyback on that a little bit too, simply to say that one of the things I thought that Little Women does beautifully, very much in context of this idea about Jo, and the same could be said also for Amy.
Yeah, that's true.
Is that a lot of what they portray in how it unfolded actually was almost a redefining of community itself. Because when I hear the word community, and I think this is true for a lot of moderns, that we hear it used almost like a geographical net. That on the news, it talks about, you know, there's a fire that's been going on and it's affected everything in your community. Or, you know, there's a community drive, you know, and we're collecting coats for people who are in need. But when community is used like that as a term, it's actually not very personal. And To use it in a geographic sense is to make it very impersonal, really. What every artist needs, like every human being of any inclination, is to live in common. That's what common unity is, community. And what I saw so beautifully portrayed in Little Women is the fact that her community really were her common people, the people that she lived with in common, shared daily life with. And it affected the root system that Amy paints out of. Mm-hmm. And it created the art that Marmee made of their lives. I mean, you could look at her as an artist too and say that she was painting, but on a different kind of a canvas. And certainly Joe, you know, is wrestling with, you know, what's the point, you know, what's the point of writing if it doesn't tell the truth, if it isn't authentic? It's more than about making money.
You got at a crucial point there, I think, because when we talk about, okay, so when we say centric genius, what do we mean? We don't mean conformist per se. We don't mean you have to make this list of everything that you are and anything that you think you are and anything that you like, oh, well, going against that must be right because it hurts, it feels wrong. Hmm. That's not quite what we mean. Mm-hmm. We mean that you understand who you are in relation to a center. Mm-hmm. And in ancient context, that was understood in the sense of, well, God is the center. And then you've got the church as a sort of a concentric circle closest to that. And you can kind of work your way out from there towards what you might call the fringes, more towards chaos, rather than living willingly in the chaos. There is a sense that whoever I am, whoever God has called me to be, it is in relation to that center and it is in the service of the center. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you lose if you get away from that I heard towards the end of what you were just saying, Lancia, is the moral element. As an artist, as a Christian artist, you actually don't have the luxury of saying, oh, I'm a terrible person, but I'm a great artist. Mm-hmm. We've talked about that from a different context on this podcast. Mm-hmm. We've talked about the fact that bad people can give birth to good children and that that's true for art as well. However, if you're the artist, if you're the one making the choices, you don't actually get to quit on that side of it. I'm going to give up on being a parent. I'm going to give up on being a spouse. I'm going to give up on being a productive member of a society, and I'm just going to paint. That is kind of the heroic ideal, though, in our culture, isn't it? You're seen as, if you abandon all of those things and pursue a dream, that's supposed to be something heroic.
Right. Well, and that comes from the Romantic tradition, capital R, Romantic, the 18th century movement within the arts, in which there was a shift away from the idea that art expresses something beyond itself. Art comes from something, as you just beautifully said, there's a center. Right? There's something to draw from. And to the extent that the artist expresses that thing, they are successful as an artist. Their art is good or bad. But the locus of the source of that art is external to the artist. That was before the Romantics. And for most of human history, that was the idea. You make something, and insofar as that thing that you make conforms to truth or goodness or beauty or God or whatever, you know, family, whatever that source is, but the source is external to the artist. With the Romantic movement, capital R Romantic movement, there was a shift from expressionism to impressionism. And we've heard that in terms of painting, right? Monet was an impressionist. But there's something much more at stake with that shift. The idea that art is an expression of the artist. Whatever you make is an expression of what's internal and subjective to the artist. And so therefore, the artist must be some kind of special person, right? Because if we're creating art that is an impression of the artist, then the artist has to be some kind of heroic, special kind of misanthropic person who has something to say that's better than what the ordinary person has to say, that's better than what the institutions or what God or religion or whatever has to say. The artist then becomes the expert on their art. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that the artist is somebody special, then their art will be somebody special. And there's something so seductive about that, but very dangerous about that idea.
It's very isolating.
Yes. And then where there becomes this romantic ideal to the isolation. Sure, I'm depressed and sure, I'm full of all these painful emotions, but that's how I'm supposed to feel because I'm an artist and I have something to say, capitalized, something to say, right? And that still has trickled down even within the church so that there are Christian artists who think that they're trying to express themselves rather than expressing something that is greater than us, something transcendent that we can connect to, certainly, right? That's why art is specific. We tell a story. We paint a picture. So art is very specific and precise, but there's something about that romantic ideal that's a distortion.
Absolutely. Because one of the things that it fundamentally does is that it makes artists disconnected from the whole of the society in which they're born. It's a way of disenfranchising people from the beginning. And you can look at a lot of different ways that artists define themselves, but one of the great poverties of our particular time period is that people are being born with tremendous gifts, you know, just as they always have. And yet there's so little understanding of how those gifts are used in a way to serve the art, serve, you know, their own soul, serve their families, serve the community in which they live. I mean, people don't understand even what the roots of great art actually amount to. There's just no context. And what's so critical about the concept of a centric genius is that it's a centered genius. The other word for that would be whole. Mm. You know, that we look for what it means to become whole in our art, to be a whole human being, to be integrated. And you cannot become a human doing in, you know, in the sense that I am a painter or I am a photographer and therefore, or I'm a writer or a singer or actress or dancer, whatever the artistic discipline is. If you become just the thing that is your discipline of your art, then you're no longer really a whole person. You still have to eat and, you know, sleep and, you know, live with a spouse or children or, you know, family and dogs, and you still have to make a living. All those things make up a whole life. And one of the things that I think is so critical in all this is just being able to redefine what it means to be successful as a whole person who happens to also be an artist.
Well, on some level, this is so intuitive and so basic for a Christian. It's a bit trickier for it to be quite so intuitive if you're not, just not to say it's not intuitive at all. But for the Christian, the call is fairly basic. It's fairly straightforward. Love your neighbor.
Right.
Love God and love your neighbor. In the post-Gospels context, be a member of the body of Christ. You don't get out of jail free card from these commandments because you're gifted with a paintbrush or can string words together intelligently. And on the most basic level, you've just created a conflict between the modern ideal of the artist and what you might feel you might be called to as an artist and what you are clearly called to as a Christian.
Right.
And that's a challenging thing to deal with. And that's why we see actually in the guild a profound in artists, and not just in our arts guild, but in the community that we work in as a whole, we see a profound discomfort with the term Christian artist. And part of that is because it's been used to describe a certain industry driven subset of art that's very preachy and moralistic. But I think also it's because there's an instinctive discomfort with putting those two words together. Mm-hmm. it's hard to know what to do with them when you put them together. So what most of the artists end up doing is they end up saying, well, I'm not a Christian artist. I'm an artist who is a Christian. And the question that they are then wrestling with is, how do I bring those two things together?
Right. Brian, can you talk a little more about that? What is it that the artists in the guild that you're working with, what are they resisting with that particular phrase, Christian artist?
I mean, the story varies a bit from person to person. There's definitely people who had a bad experience with, say, the Christian fiction publishing industry. Mm-hmm. I wrote what I thought was a brilliant book, and they didn't want it because there wasn't a conversion story at the end.
Right.
Or because the themes in it were too serious. Sometimes it's along those kinds of lines. But I also think that they have been forced to a large extent. And here, I don't want this to sound like we're sitting here criticizing artists for doing it wrong. This is the world. If you're gifted in an artistic field, this is the world that you've been born into.
That's right.
This is the hand you've been dealt. And so on the one hand, you have this experience. Maybe you were raised in a Christian home. Maybe you converted at some point later in your life, but you got this identity and you have some level of attachment to it. Maybe you're a little bit at the fringe of your church because you had a bad experience with a pastor who told you you were going to hell for reading Harry Potter or something like that. But more than likely, you're in an okay position in your church, but you don't really know how this artist side of you fits into it. And then on the flip side, if you want to pursue your craft, if you want to be excellent at this thing that you do, whether it's writing stories or poetry, or dancing or whatever, well, who do you have to hang out with in order to do that? Hang out with right. the best people in that craft. It won't be the Christians. It will be a secular a religious at any rate group that is mostly not Christians and that are pursuing, even if the group does include Christians, a heroic ideal that clashes with what you hear at church on Sunday morning as a heroic ideal.
Right.
I think that's one of the calls, though, of being a Christian artist, just by the nature of it. I mean, I am an artist. I know that the art that I make through photography or through web design in particular, but even in my writing, none of those things would be focused on the kind of beauty that they are were I not rooted in Christ. So there's no way from my standpoint as an artist that I could ever just say I'm an artist. Well, how ridiculous. I mean, that would be like trying to take my gender away. I am a Christian. I am a woman. I am white. I mean, as much as that disappoints me, I prayed, dang it, you know, to be some other color. And the Lord just left me, you know, a vanilla cookie. And I just didn't get any vote about that. But those things, to be able to say I am, is a really important part of making peace with our own identity and the identity that is given to us and the identity into which we ultimately end up growing. That's a thing that we get to work out, you know, in community, in a group of core relationships where we're loved. You know, and so I'm looking at people who struggle with this and Christian artists, you're right, do oftentimes end up spending time honing craft, you know, developing creative excellence in the company of people who don't believe because they equally have committed, you know, to developing their discipline. And that is one of the reasons that it is so lonely, you know, as an artist, because you will find 90% of the people that you spend time developing your art with don't share the roots in Christ. And yet I think the Lord uses that. What's critical is that we still have some place to go home to at night, you know, like the Anselm Arts Guild, you know, or hopefully we have a family system that understands those things that we wrestle with. But I think to some extent, my hope is that, you know, we find some ways to make peace with what it is that we mean when we say, I am a Christian, I am a Christ follower, and I am a photographer.
In that order.
Yes.
It's a crucial thing because
it is.
This is another sense in which the term centric genius is helpful. Because if you think about it in mm-hmm. terms of that image of yes. concentric circles or in terms of a hierarchy, you know, there's another word you're not supposed to use these days, hierarchy. But if the things that matter in your life, if you can handle the tension of having the things that matter in your life rightly ordered,
yes.
one above another, that puts you in a place where you don't have to choose between good and bad, important, unimportant. Those aren't the only two types of, it's not this binary thing. You've got one or the other. You don't have to choose between God and your art. If you pursue art, there's this concept, I'll step back for a moment. There's this concept in theology. The Roman Catholic theologian, William Cavanaugh, uses this term. I love it. It's migrations of the holy. Mm. And you see it in the writings of Edmund Burke in the 18th century, this idea that basically you've got a, for lack of a better term, you have a God-shaped hole in your heart. I mean, to use the cliche, but if you don't have God there, you'll put something there instead. Worship is simply worth-ship, ascribing ultimate worth to something. And art is for many an alternative religion because it is semi-transcendent. It does connect you with something bigger. I mean, there's a reason the Anselm Society exists because we think art does serve an incredibly important function in allowing us to see beyond the material. But if it's not, if transcendent isn't about transcending to something, towards something, if there isn't an ultimate goal, if you say, I am an artist and I demote God in order to pursue that art, your art will in fact suffer.
Absolutely.
Whereas if you put God at the center, and instead of holding this part of who you are back from him, say, this is yours. You gave this to me. I give it back to you. Bless it, complete it, perfect it. That's when you can start to take off as an artist. And that's where we try to take people with our guild. It's on this journey from, oh, I don't want to be a Christian artist, I'm an artist who is a Christian, to this third stop where it's, you're an artist Christian. Christian's the noun, artist is the modifier. Artist is how you particularly are called to be a Christian, not the other way around.
Mm-hmm. Right. So have y'all read anything by Daniel Borstein? He wrote a series of books on the discoverers, the great events of Western culture. He's a librarian of Congress and a secular Jew, an atheist. And he wrote, like I said, these series of books on, the great discoveries and people in Western culture who've most shaped Western culture. So he did an interview a few years ago, and the interviewer asked him, what was the biggest surprise you encountered in doing research for your book? And his answer was, the greatest surprise to me was how important the Christian faith was in the Western tradition. And he said, because I'm an atheist, I don't even believe in God. But he said, there is no way we would have this rich tradition, unparalleled in the history of the world, without the Christian faith. And he went on to talk about how a belief in a creator then motivated generations of the greatest thinkers and discoverers and writers and artists that the world has ever known to create like the God that they believed in.
Mm.
And he also then talked about how the Judeo-Christian faith believes in a redemption of suffering. And because of that, there was an ethic of redemption that informed the entire Western tradition. Now, I'm not setting apart the Western tradition as the greatest tradition. He was. I'm not. But what he's saying is extremely important, I think, for us as artists to know in looking back on the greatest artists that the world has known, they are overwhelmingly believers. Overwhelmingly, they're believers. So the idea of this kind of tortured artist who's off at the fringes, not believing in anything, and that that's somehow some kind of ideal, flies in the face of history and absolutely undercuts the great and rich tradition that we actually do have of artists. Sure, there's plenty of atheists and there's plenty of people who followed other religions and other faiths. That's true, especially more modern. You know, Monet, for example, talking about Impressionists, he was an atheist. And he created great art, beautiful art, and we should go look at it and we shouldn't throw it out because he was an atheist. But Shakespeare, right? But Dostoevsky, these people who do understand what it means to suffer. They do understand what pain is and lived a fully human life. And so there were times when they were lonely and abandoned and all those things too. But overwhelmingly, we're talking about the great artists and discoverers of the world were people of faith, or at least shaped by a culture of faith.
That's just very important to talk about what it means to be shaped by a culture of faith, because it is absolutely true that people who've created some of the art that defines who we are may not have been, you know,
devout
people, but their moral structure and their sense of the context of worldview was framed, like it or not, you know, by a Christian worldview, a theistic worldview. And understanding that mindset, you know, whether it's the medieval mindset or whether it was later mindsets, we can watch the unraveling of the identity of artists and really the deconstruction of the identity of what it means to be an artist, you know, as we look at the growth of the Enlightenment, which I've always found to be the most ironic of names because it was the least enlightened, you know, in that respect, you know, and the further that artists are talked about in context of being removed from being human, because really that's what we're talking about, the more unsuccessful they become in having, you know, lives that are meaningful and sustainable for themselves, but also the art that they produce becomes increasingly deconstructionist. It doesn't give life to people. It deconstructs it. I mean, what happens when you're dissecting something in science, you're not making it come back alive. You're taking it apart so that it's dead. I mean, it may be dead when you're dissecting it, but it isn't for the purpose of reinfusing it with life. And when you look at a lot of modern art in particular, of every spectrum, it is not with the intention of restoring life or imbuing the viewer or the listener with courage or with hope or with dignity. It's very self-centric, which ultimately becomes a form of dying.
Right. That's T.S. Eliot called it fragments, right? Fragments that we shore against our ruin. And this idea that we go out and kind of salvage these fragments and then we build ourselves a little barricade using those fragments against the encroaching darkness of the world. And that's a very bleak way of viewing the role of the artist. And frankly, it's a caving in to the encroaching darkness, right? As artists, we, as you say, to be emboldened by virtue, for goodness, truth, and beauty to be woven into. That doesn't mean that we avoid the darkness, because we have to tell the truth about the darkness, right? That's part of creating art. We tell the truth about the darkness. We name it. You talked earlier about the owning of I am, right? Mm-hmm. One of the artist's great vocations is to name things.
Amen.
And so we have to name darkness as well as light. And so I think so much as what, Brian, as you were talking about earlier, of the resistance to the idea of being a Christian artist is somehow this fear that we can't tell the truth anymore. We're not given the ability to say and to name the darkness in our art and to let our art be haunted by the fall. And one of the things I love about Anselm and about so many of the artists who are doing work in Anselm and the art that we study and we look at and behold in Anselm, because artists who are naming the dark, who are saying, this is a hard place to live. The world is a fallen place. And here's some ways in which it's fallen. And you portray that. And then also tell the rest of the story, right? Tell the story of redemption. Tell the story of how we are given back our name and restored to relationship and with God and with each other, which again goes back to that's something we have to live out ourselves. We have to know what it means to be restored with ourselves, with our God, and with each other, and with the church. And then we can tell that whole story.
That's well said. And it's, I think, a crucial thing to note that we're not saying in all of this is try harder, stupid.
That's right.
And we're not saying, oh, this is, God, why, you know, this is so easy. Why didn't you notice this? You couldn't possibly be in as bad a situation as you think you are. We're not saying any of those things.
No, we need you.
On the contrary, what we want to be able to do in this as a society, as a whole, and particularly over the next few months, is give you an alternative narrative to live into, give you alternative heroes, alternative images. We are actually going to tell you the stories of churches that did a better job loving their artists and welcoming them in. We're going to tell you the stories of artists who, because they offered what they had to God, even though they suffered, they did not ultimately have to choose between being beloved of God and beloved of their craft. They did not have to choose because they chose rightly. And when they did, everything, God gave everything back to them, blessed and renewed. So there's, I think what we want to be able to show through this continuing conversation is a number of different things. We want you as artists, as friends of artists, as church-going Christians, we want our listeners to be able to engage with the questions of where they fit into all of this, get a different picture of what things could be like. Mm-hmm. And for the artist, what is my relationship to truth? How does that work? How does that play out in my craft? What's my relationship to authority, to restriction, to the kinds of things that as an artist I'm told I'm not supposed to like, but as a Christian I'm told I'm supposed to accept and even love?
Right.
And for those who do not consider themselves artists, we want to be able to give them a vision for, hey, you know that person at the back of your church that's really hard to talk to? You don't get to skip loving God and loving your neighbor either. You don't get to go, oh, well, they're hard to talk to. I asked them about what they did and they said I was a painter and I didn't know what to ask next. So I made an excuse and left. The non-artists, the quote-unquote normal people, are not, in fact, off the hook. Mm-hmm. So in our next episode, we are going to continue the conversation and focus a bit on that other side of it. We cannot possibly answer everything that comes to the artist side of it in one podcast, and we're not going to try to do the same with the community around the artist side of it either, but we want to be able to introduce you to our listeners some ideas and some alternative questions to start asking that you can continue to ask over the course of this winter and spring with us. So we will see you next time.